Sorry. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. My name is Mike Gibb. I was on mute that entire time. Apologize. Never done that before. I run accountsrecovery.net, apparently not very well, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on analyzing the CFPB's proposed time-barred debt disclosure rule. The CFPB has issued a supplemental notice of its intention to enact a rule related to disclosures when collecting on time-barred debt. Today, in a webinar being sponsored by TCN, we have a panel of leading compliance experts with us from across the credit collection industry who are here to discuss the impact of what the CFPB has proposed and how companies should move forward. As I mentioned, this webinar is being generously sponsored by TCN. You get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. Let me tell you a little bit today about today's speakers. Stephanie Jackman is the leader of Ballard Spahr's debt collection team and a partner located in the firm's Atlanta office. She is nationally recognized for her expertise in collections, compliance, and litigation across all segments of the financial services industry, including traditional financial products, fintech, and online lending, healthcare, and student lending. Joanne Needleman is leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory and Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She's the immediate past president of the Board of Directors of the National Creditors Bar Association and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. Rick Purr is the co-managing partner of the Philadelphia office of the law firm Kaufman, Dolowitz, and Baluch. He also chairs the firm's National Consumer Financial Services Practice Group. He is a nationally recognized authority and lecturer on creditors' rights, representing creditors, law firms, and agencies against individual and class action allegations, invoking federal and state consumer protection laws, including the FDCPA, the FDRA, and the TCPA. Rick is a past president of ACA International and currently sits on its board of directors. Britt Suttle works in the Pennsylvania office of Barron & Neuberger. She's a member of the firm's Consumer Financial Services Law Practice Group. Prior to joining the firm, she was a shareholder at Burton Neal & Associates, where she served as the firm's director of compliance. Britt is president of the Pennsylvania State Creditors Bar and is a current member of the board of directors for the National Creditors Bar Association and is immediate past parliamentarian of the National Creditors Bar Association. Thanks to them for joining us today. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the next day or so on accountsrecovery.net webinar recordings page. As well, I want to ask everybody to take a minute and reserve a minute actually and fill out the feedback form that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from. Before I bring in our speakers and start our discussion, I wanted to read also the following disclaimer. This presentation and event is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area. It should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, let's start talking about what the CFPB has done most recently. Let's talk about the proposed time-barred debt disclosure rule and why is it important to the industry. Joanne, why don't we give you first crack at it?
Oh, well, thank you. And good afternoon, everybody, and good afternoon to my panelists, and thanks for letting me join in this conversation. So quickly, because I know others want to comment as well, last week the CFPB issued a supplemental notice of proposed rule, which focused on time-barred debt disclosures. This was nothing new. We knew this was coming when the CFPB issued the NPR, the Notice of Proposed Rule, in May. They did basically tell us that there was a placeholder in those proposals for time-barred debt disclosures and that they were in the process of doing some testing. That testing has concluded, and these proposals now are being put forth. In a nutshell, and I know we're all going to dive real deep into this, what the Bureau is saying is that if you want to communicate with consumers where a debt may be time-barred, or at least you know or should know that the debt may be time-barred, You have to, in your at least initial communication or invalidation notice, whichever is appropriate, to give certain disclosures about the debt being time barred. The proposal also talks about some timing issues, meaning if you had given if you had communicated with the consumer before, but later learned that the debt was time barred, when those disclosures should be given, or maybe throughout the course of the collection process, you found out the debt did become time barred, you would have to give subsequent disclosures. I think one of the most positive things about this is that they have given us exact language of what you have to say. And I'm sure Rick will talk a lot about, and Britt, and Stephanie, about all the wonderful cases that they have had to deal with, where language has been dissected and it could, would, should, may be sued, could be sued. We have exactly what we need to say. So hopefully that puts an end to conflicting interpretations of what was a proper disclosure. I'm going to stop there and let some others comment, but that overall, that is what the Bureau has done and did last week.
I'll jump in and add a little bit to what Joanne had to say to answer the question of why did the CFPB do this? And I'll answer it in maybe a little bit more cynical look at it, which is this is the best they could do. The argument out there is, and of course, if anyone's read any of the articles that have been written from other sides, both commentary from the industry, commentary from groups that purport to represent consumer interests, you know, they'll argue that you need to put a bright line in the sand, but that doesn't take a look at the practical realities of politics, which is that statutes of limitation are controlled by state governments, state legislatures. They dictate what goes on in that type of system, and in our federal state-based system, the states control statute of limitations. The CFPB it has been enabled through an act of Congress that doesn't give it any more power beyond simply the confines of the FDCPA. The FDCPA does not identify anywhere in it a bar to collecting out-of-statute debt or make any attempt to preempt state law. So the CFPB is stuck in that it can only legislate to the extent of its authority. And in this case, while there may be certain people within the CFPB or others who think that they want to address a public policy concern related to out-of-statute debt, the fact is they can't invoke a unilateral ban or bar. It would be overturned. It would be fought. And particularly now in the fact that I'll again go out on a limb and say that it is a more conservative bent to the CFPB in its current iteration than in its prior iteration. Their viewpoint on the government structure, federal versus state, wouldn't even probably be an area where they would want to step on the toes of the states to try and come up with some federal edict over it. So we got as far as the CFPB politically is willing to go and probably legally can go to try and curtail the collection of time bar debt as best as it can. And like anything else, when you compromise or when you do something, you end up with a number of inconsistencies and questions that are raised that hopefully will play itself out as comments come into the Bureau.
Awesome. Excellent. Thanks. Really appreciate the opening insights. I'm sure one of the questions that a lot of people listening and in the industry have is how does this supplemental rule affect the release of the final debt collection rule, which is supposed to be at some point this year? So will there be any change in that, or do you foresee any change in that as a result of what the CFPB has done with the supplemental rule? Stephanie?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. You read my mind because I was going to volunteer to handle this. And just first thank you to you, Mike, for involving me. And I'm you know, really flattered to be joined by Rick and Joanne and Britt in talking to all of you about this supplemental rule. Well, the short answer is I have absolutely no idea because I don't have a crystal ball, and sometimes I'm not sure that the Bureau can guarantee its timing. My expectation is this won't impact it at all. The Bureau, I mean, it could, but I don't think it will. As Joanne and Rick already mentioned, the Bureau was planning to put this out. They told us they were going to do it last May in the the NPRM. So many acronyms. I can't keep it. Now we're the SPRM. So they were anticipating doing this. They have moved, at least on a kind of non-committal basis, the original Q2 2020 publication goal to last I've heard, and it doesn't seem to have changed, sometime in Q3, so I'm thinking August, September. And of course, that can always be a little bit flexible, but that still seems to at least be the Bureau's internal target as best as I can tell. So here, there's certainly plenty of time for comments to come in and for the Bureau to take what is gained from this supplemental notice and implement it in the final rule. So I think we're going to see it all come back together and come out as one. And I still expect that to happen, or I shouldn't say expect, but am anticipating that's likely to happen in the fall, kind of Q3, maybe a couple of weeks into Q4. I think we'll have our final rule before the end of this year.
Yeah, this is Britt, and I agree with Stephanie. Stephanie, I think that you exactly the same timeline that I'm working on. However, I think that the fact that the final rule has been pushed back until later in 2020, Rick mentioned earlier politics. Politics always comes into play. And so I think that the fact that there is an enormous election coming up also in the fall, late fall, is that going to impact, a final rule? Could that impact the timing? It's possible. Could it impact the implementation, even if the final rule is published? I certainly could expect that, especially if, the Senate flips, and then you have both houses of Congress who might not like the rule because maybe they don't think it's consumer friendly enough. So I agree. With Stephanie's timeline, I definitely think it's gonna come out in 2020. My guess is later Q3, but definitely 2020, early Q4.
This is Rick, I would throw another just blip in there on the politics end, which is something we haven't talked about on timing, which is if the Supreme Court should weigh in on the constitutionality of the director and hold the CFPB director can be fired for any reason, and that opinion comes out before the election, you might see something hastened in terms of being put out with the concern that the current director wouldn't have her job post January 2021 if there should be a change of administration. So the possibility exists that the Supreme Court could accidentally cause this to move up. If various stakeholders were to, be so inclined.
Okay, good point. I just want to pause the discussion briefly and say a little bit about the sponsor of today's webinar. That's TCN. TCN is a leading provider of cloud-based call center technology for enterprises, contact centers, BPOs, and collection agencies worldwide. Founded in 1999, TCN combines a deep understanding of the needs of call center users with a highly affordable delivery model, ensuring immediate access to robust call center technology such as predictive dialer, IVR, call recording, and business analytics required to optimize operations and adhere to TCPA regulations. Its always-on cloud-based delivery model provides customers with immediate access to the latest version of the TCN solution, as well as the ability to quickly and easily scale to adjust to evolving business needs. TCN serves various Fortune 500 companies and enterprises in multiple industries, including newspaper, collection, education, healthcare, automotive, political, customer service, and marketing. TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding TCPA changes and how it is changing the industry. TCN regularly speaks to local and national leaders to help educate them in matters on matters of TCPA and compliance for the betterment of the industry as a whole. For more information, please visit www.tcn.com. Thanks again to TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. I'm sure I speak for all of us listening when I say we greatly appreciate your generous support. Now, before I get back to the discussion topics at hand, we've had a number of questions come in, so I want to use this as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question for the panel, type it in, and we'll try and get to it before we wrap up today. The first question that's come in, if you send a letter with the disclosures and the mail does not come back, do you still have to give the disclosure verbally? This person thinks yes, but looks forward to the feedback. Does anyone want to take that one?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, I think there's nothing in the SPNR, like Stephanie, I can't figure out my acronym, and the NPR that says anything about confirming, it's where when you're talking about a letter, confirming receipt, and even the FDCPA doesn't have any issue, it doesn't have any language in it that says receipt has to be confirmed. Now, obviously, if a letter comes back, you know it hasn't been received. But if a letter goes out and it doesn't come back and you don't have any notice that it wasn't delivered, the act says that the consumer has been given notice. So the way I read the SNPR, if it's put in that validation notice and that is your initial communication, I think you have satisfied the requirements of the proposals.
Okay. Here's a similar question. I think it's similar. I mean, I don't think it's the same. If it is the same, please let me know. A debtor calls to pay on a time-barred account. Are there any disclosures the collector must provide to take the payment? This is assuming that the initial collection notice went out well before the statute of limitations had passed. Is that the same answer as before, or is that different?
Well, I would say, I guess I would have a follow-up to this question. It says, assuming the initial collection notice went out before the SOL passed. So, you know, again, this is, and I think we're going to get into this a little later, that is some of the concerns I have with this timing of these timing proposals. You know, yes, you sent out your traditional community, you had initial communication, or you sent out your validation notice, and at the time, the debt was not time barred. And then along the way, it becomes time barred. The way I read the rule based on this scenario, for what I think that they are asking is, that would, if that is a first communication, after you know or should have known, or even if you didn't know before, but you do know now that the debt is time barred, you have to make a disclosure to that consumer, I think, before you can accept that payment. That's the way I'm reading it. And Stephanie, tell me if I'm wrong or right here.
Well, I think the thing is, none of us know if we're wrong or right yet, because there's, as you note, a lot in the proposal that is, it seems to be clear, but it's not, and it's going to be very situational. Mm-hmm. I agree with you, and I was thinking about if this is your first communication with the consumer, right? They just happen to do an inbound to you and it's time barred. Yes, I think you have to give the disclosure. If it's your first verbal communication with them, but you already sent a validation notice by letter, I probably would think you have to give a disclosure. And then to your point, if it's changed in the interim, you have to give a disclosure. And I mean, if I'm thinking operationally, if a client were to ask,
yeah,
if we're reading it right, what should I do? Well, from a just ease of implementation, remind everybody, unless you can prove you already did, hey, are you sure you want to pay me today? I mean, that is kind of what's being at least proposed, because you know that that's one of the ways it will be attacked if you don't, that it's UDAP, that it's unfair, it's deceptive, it's a violation of Section 806, 807, 808, and you're not going to get the safe harbor either. I mean, keep in mind, the safe harbor the Bureau is proposing has to do with using their forms, and it's a safe harbor just for purposes of that form, and then hopefully they've linked it in the larger rule to also be a safe harbor from Section 809 with the validation notice in general, so we don't have another whole mess of litigation over there. But it certainly wouldn't extend to cover a situation where, to your point, Joanne, you took a payment and you can't show the consumer was ever advised that it was time barred. And then what happens if you're wrong? You know, the know or should know standard for the listeners, we were talking about this ahead of time, and I know we're going to get to it more, but that's another way for it. What if it was time barred and you didn't realize? And maybe you shouldn't have. Maybe you didn't realize the consumer had moved. So they didn't tell you. They're just making a payment. And then after the fact, you're getting attacked and having to prove that. It will be very challenging. So it might be a best practice. I'm not saying do this. And I imagine most companies will not want to do this. But I think in some ways, to avoid litigation, as currently proposed, one more warning before you take that payment, which no one's going to want to do.
Right. And I think, Stephanie, you brought up an interesting point. If it's a call-in and it's after, you know, long after, you know, you've sent the validation notice, which was before the statute of limitations ran, but let's say the consumer doesn't even call in. Let's say they just go to your website to make a payment.
Amen.
Do you have to, what now? Are you going to have a pop-up? Yeah. Are you going to have that disclosure on your screen? Again, saying, wait, do you really want to pay this? Because, you know, you don't really have to, but, you know, it's time barred. So, I mean, I don't think it's just limited to phone calls and letters anymore, especially, you know, especially with the rise in text messaging and email and web payments. I mean, web payments are so easy. And, you know, I mean, so I think the question is, are you going to need to add it to your payment portals? And I think
excellent point.
I think you probably should. I mean, I'm very conservative when it comes to compliance. So, you know, if the disclosure is mandated and there's a possibility that the consumer could move and there's a possibility that, you know, the debt could be out of statute, give them the disclosure.
Yep.
Well, we talked a little bit about it, but let's maybe spend a few minutes digging deeper. And one of the things the CFPB is attempting to determine is whether it should go with a strict liability standard or as what we talked about, a new or should have known standard. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what the differences are and share some ideas or perspectives on under which format do you foresee the proposed rule moving forward. Rick, do you want to kick us off on that one?
Sure. As a practical matter, strict liability is simply if you did something wrong, doesn't matter why you did it wrong or what was the reason, it's a violation. Speed limit's 55. If you're driving 56, the law doesn't care. You could be racing to the emergency room. You could be doing anything. You could accidentally step on the gas pedal. Your car speedometer could be wrong. If someone objectively has you at 56 and in a 55, you're liable. And for the most part, many sections of the FDCPA prescribe that as the holding on a violation. It didn't matter if you forgot a word, if something happened. Now, the bona fide error defense comes in, of course, in trying to defeat that. But as a general proposition, that's the strict liability. The know or should have known, which I'm sure many people in the arm industry would argue should be on a lot of the areas of the FDCPA. And this is probably in part where that hybrid of the CFPB trying to implement something that's not expressly written anywhere in the FDCPA, yet utilizing their authority under the Dodd-Frank Act to come up with something in order to regulate a process that they can't go far enough in regulating, comes up with this know or shouldn't or should know. And that stems in large part because, quite frankly, even the most skilled lawyer, including all of my distinguished panelists, probably if given a law school exam of what is the statute of limitations on a debt, would have a hard time trying to figure it out in a lot of different circumstances. What state were people in? What are they in now? What type of debt is it? Is it covered by statutes of limitations, which in some ways are governed by the nature of what the obligation is? Is it in writing? Was it oral? Is a doctor's medical debt considered oral or written? Well, you know, that all argues, are you now living in California or are you living in Florida? When it was incurred, where were you living? And so all of these things come into play of what is the statute of limitations? Didn't it expire? Was it ever renewed? Did you make payments? There's just so many different facts that become involved in trying to do that, to hold a group of people or companies responsible absolutely for a legal determination that most people couldn't figure out, and in some cases needs court. You need a court to intervene after an extensive amount of discovery to determine what the statute of limitations is, seems to be just unfair and punitive. And I think that's, to that extent, the CFPB has recognized that to impose strict liability would involve a massive amount of argument about what is ultimately the exact statute of limitations for any particular obligation. And I don't know that it's easily determinable in any way, shape, or form. And I think that in this case, most companies are just going to err on the side of caution and give these disclosures, as you know, the panelists have already previously indicated. You're just not going to take a chance. You're going to do it, understanding that I mean, there's not as much harm in giving the disclosure if you're at or about a rough idea of where you think the statute of limitations is at that time.
And there's two thoughts. I agree with you, Rick, and also adding two things to it. While the Bureau is apparently no longer proposing that a determination something is time barred will not be binding if it's, you know, if the account is placed with another agency down the road or something happens and everybody can make their own determinations. But then what does that mean if somebody reaches a different determination? The Bureau had lots of comments in the introduction to the supplemental notice talking about consumers and how they make choices about what debts are going to pay and what debts are going to pay more attention to, and the fact that something is time barred might cause them not to pay it. Whereas if it turns out that I made that decision, I was incorrect in that, and they didn't pay it, and interest keeps accruing, or, you know, it goes further into the process, it ends up in collection litigation, it starts being adversely reported, what's to stop that consumer from coming back and suing me for violating the FDCPA and UDAP, as crazy as it sounds, for not having actually realized that wasn't the case and misrepresenting it was time barred? So that was comment one. And then number two, to your point, Rick, when you're trying to defend yourself as the agency or the collector in court about this know or should know, what in the world are the standards? And, you know, Mike, you said, well, do we think it's likely they'll stay with know or should know versus strict liability? Honestly, if they don't give some contours, I don't think it matters, because they'll essentially all be strict liability in that it's just, how does this judge feel today? What is the circumstance of this case? How am I supposed to determine the applicable statute of limitations when perhaps I haven't had any contact with this consumer for 2 years? A lot can happen in that time. I have a lawsuit right now where a consumer moved. And if I don't know, I might be applying the wrong statute. Can I look at the last address that they were contacted at, or we sent mail that wasn't returned? Do I need to do a scrub? Do I need to look at the U.S. Postal Service? What are appropriate places to source potential updated address information? What if their area code for the last number I had is different? We need some sort of know or should know can be determined by looking at these reference points, or else, as I said, it doesn't matter because it's not a real standard.
Right. Stephanie, that's exactly was going to be my answer, is that does it, at the end of the day, it might not matter if the Bureau defines it as know or should have known unless they go further. Because at the end of the day, if it's know or should have known, you're going to be engaging in the exact same lengthy amount of discovery as you would have if it was strict liability and you were asserting the bona fide error defense. Right. You know, so I think the Bureau, should they come out with more and provide, as you said, some contours? Yes, probably, because I, at the end of the day, just the know or should have known versus the strict liability with respect to at least this issue probably isn't going to matter as far as litigating these claims too much in terms of the amount of cost and discovery that's going to need to happen. So, unfortunately, I do not foresee, and I will defer to the expert in Joanne, I do not see the CFPB providing us any of those contours.
Well, I think that's what the comment period is about. And that's where comments are important, getting them into the administrative record. I think that those can be included with some standards, and hopefully the CFPB will look to them. But it's going to be tough. It is going to be tough because, unfortunately, I mean, ironically, we have wanted rules and wanted guidance from the Bureau on the FDCPA since 1977. What we don't want is to have these rules be yet another platform to determine what those standards are in court. And based on what the three of you have said, that's exactly what's going to happen. We, in our little call pre-webinar call, we were talking about this, and to me, it reminds me of meaningful involvement for non-attorneys. Because what did the collector or the agency do beforehand where they should have known? Or if they claim that they didn't know, why didn't they know? And it's going to have to be a Monday morning quarterback of all of your processes and procedures and how you put these files together and how you monitor them and how they change and what your operations are going to look like. And depending on what collection agency A does in one jurisdiction may be very different than what collection agency B does in another jurisdiction. And it will depend on what the court says in those particular jurisdictions. So it is, I would, if you're thinking about commenting for those on the call, I think that's a really excellent point to make to the Bureau and provide alternatives. I mean, that's what this comment period is about.
That was going to be my next question was, what advice would you give to people in the industry in terms of, what they should focus on with their comments? To help sort of triangulate or help kind of point the CFPB in a direction that makes the most sense for everybody. Does anybody else have any comments about what they think people should say in their comments?
Well, thinking about the comment that I made initially about how do we even take comfort that we've done enough to determine that we know where the consumer is located if it turns out after the fact that we were incorrect in order to be able to make an argument. I think data, the Bureau loves data and they keep asking for data. Every page in this was give us more data, 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 data. They like data. So if you have data that talks about how often you discover that a consumer you thought lived in one place lives somewhere else, if for anybody in trade groups that are out there, if there's ways to look at the number of cases alleged claiming collection lawsuits or filed in the wrong venue. I mean, just data to show that that's a real thing to help have the Bureau understand why these types of touch points for what they think is reasonable in applying the know or should know is really not just essential, but based on what our actual experience is collecting debts. And therefore something that we are supported and is evidenced by that experience in asking for that type of additional contouring, because I don't think they're going to want to give it.
Right. I think you also have to couch, Stephanie's right, it is about data and our industry has not been great in putting that data together. But if you are intending to comment, I think you also have to couch your comments in terms of cost benefit. This, as Rick says, iteration of the Bureau has been more in tune with the idea of cost-benefit analysis, which is very much ingrained in the Administrative Procedures Act, more so than maybe the prior iteration of the Bureau. But that is really, at the end of the day, what rises and falls when you're looking at these regulations to see whether they are arbitrary or capricious, to see whether they are, they're doing what they're supposed to do. So if whether you're a trade association, whether you're an individual collection agency or an individual entity, and like we had said in the NPR, I think everybody should comment in some way. No comment is a bad comment, in my opinion, especially from industry. And I think you have to, educate the Bureau about your processes, how things are done. And because of these proposals, what the additional costs are going to be, how it's going to, if in fact it is a disruption to your operations and could change your operations, you need to really articulate that.
Right, I agree, you have to comment. I think very similar to the NPR, the big event, just because this is maybe the post-game show, I think you still need to comment. One thing to look at, especially for agencies, because you think of figuring out a statute of limitations. And if you're an attorney, you know, that's supposed to be a legal determination. You're supposed to look at the case law, go through the statutes, all that. But for collection agencies, you know, they might not have an attorney on staff. They might need to hire outside counsel to figure all of this out. And I think that those are readily available or readily quantifiable numbers to show to the CFPB, which is, as you know, as was mentioned, a cost conscious right now, showing, you know, that they are cost conscious to small businesses. So I think that that's at least one area of quantifiable data.
I think there's also one more small area, I mean, at least in looking at it, that requires a comment from somewhere, someplace along the line, which is, as Joanne has pointed out, in terms of some of the flaws in communication about the using the appropriate language, and that if you're collecting a in-statute debt that turns into an out-of-statute debt, and suddenly you're now triggered with this obligation to notify the consumer about the change in status, you have one big or small problem, at least, is that the Bureau has already indicated its desire to put communication caps on your contact with consumers. So now, if you're capped out, for example, how and when and where do you now communicate if this period of in-statute to out-of-statute debt occurs, if you suddenly can't communicate with somebody for at least a week or otherwise? I mean, I think there's some internal bugs in their timing that raise a definite question that the Bureau needs to be put on notice in terms of the even the sufficiency of its call caps that it noted previously.
I want to ask what may be a stupid question, but I'm pretty good at it, so I don't mind putting myself out there and asking what I think might be asking it. Why do we need a separate disclosure for time barred debt? Why can't there just be one disclosure, one validation notice, regardless of the age of the debt, and then sort of include that in there and be done with it? Do we really need something separate to deal with debt that where the statute of limitations has run out?
Well, you know, Mike, one of the thoughts I had is the Bureau is sensitive in here. They're being sensitive in the comments to having to give legal advice to consumers. In other contexts, though, we could talk about how that's exactly what we're being asked to do. So putting that aside for a minute and taking it at face value, I tend to agree and was hopeful that is what we would have, because whether or not the debt is time barred, it seems that there's a presumption here that it's a bad thing if consumers go and talk to somebody who's a lawyer, for instance, about their rights on a debt. And I don't think that's bad. I think you should be notifying, if we're going to go down this route, and let's just assume for a minute that these are coming, let's tell them about the concept up front so the consumer can go and consult a lawyer and say, listen, what is this? Help me understand. Does it apply here? Is it an out for me? And no, we don't want to require people to hire lawyers, but for people who can't afford to get some advice, there's legal aid. So I just, part of me thinks that the CFPB is kind of talking out of both sides of its mouth here. It's saying it doesn't want collectors to be giving legal advice. That's why we're going to say that the collector will not sue you. And by the way, it's never the collector that would do it anyway. It's the creditor or the debt buyer. So that could be a problem. But yet we're going to have you do all these analyses. We're not going to tell you how to do it to figure out what the law actually is and then pick one of these four disclosures and give it to the consumer. Isn't that giving them legal advice? Wouldn't it be much better for my consumer who has moved around and I can't find him to walk in or her to walk into somebody's office and just say, hey, I got this letter. This is this old debt. Tell me what my options are, because we've alerted them to time barred debts. Can't, you know, we can't sue on them or we won't sue on them or whatever language they want to use there. And some states have revival statutes that can allow you to undo our ability to do that. And I didn't find the data that was shared about the research that was done to be compelling in saying that consumers seemed to be confused by the revival proposals that were put out. And I just started thinking, why aren't we just alerting them and candidly drafting a disclosure that encourages them to go and ask somebody who's in their state and who's knowledgeable and who's a consumer advocate, what does this mean for me?
Well, that would be too sensible.
Well, I mean, I think, Stephanie, you make a great point. I think part of the problem is, again, it gets into this talking on both sides of the mouth. If you put a disclosure like that that says, like, go seek advice, isn't that in some ways kind of hinting that there's legal action? There's a potential legal action that could be, you know, that could be involved. I mean, this is tough. Unfortunately, these proposals sometimes are not as clear as mud in certain respects, but it's tough. And I think Rick hit on it when in his opening remarks, and that statute of limitations is governed by the state. It's a legal term. It's a legal aspect. And the minute you start talking about it, we're talking about litigation. I mean, it's not a term. It's not like interest that collectors could talk about interest or charge off or something. Many talk about statute of limitations, which we know is an affirmative defense. It's not even a claim. It's just, you know, it is a defense that you may have in litigation. The minute we cross that threshold, we are getting into this murky area that is really difficult. I get where the Bureau is coming from. We've seen abuses in statute of limitations. Consumers do not understand what it means. We don't even understand what it means. But it's a murky area that, you know, it's a Pandora's box. Once you lift it, there's no turning back. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult to figure out how we navigate this that's going to be good for everybody. Because I don't, you know, and maybe they did the right thing because everybody's not particularly caring for what is being proposed. So maybe they're doing something right. I don't know. But it's a difficult proposition from the creditor down. So good luck.
All right, we've got a bunch of more questions that have come in. So let's spend a couple of minutes and we can knock some of these out. Should agencies and lawyers who do not pursue out-of-stat debt care about this rule and why?
I'll jump in and answer at least quickly, which is, how do you know you're not pursuing out-of-statute debt?
Right, exactly.
Right.
I knew it couldn't be just a yes or no answer.
Yeah.
On medical debt where a consumer has had ongoing services from a creditor, when would the disclosure be required? After the statute of limitations has expired on the oldest service, only after it has expired on the latest service?
Oh, no hard questions like that. No, I mean, that's exactly the question that needs to be asked. And that's exactly one of the comments that I hope whoever submitted that makes. Because in addition to just the high level challenges with figuring out the applicable statute of limitations, what the state laws are around revival, et cetera, you have different types of debt. And the Bureau has acknowledged that. NPRM from 2019, they were proposing, you know, four different dates that you could use in your validation notice and things like that, and that they think that would give flexibility for student loans and medical debt and credit card and all these different things. But that's a really good question. I don't know the answer. Maybe one of the other panelists does. But the first thing that I would do is, well, first I'd look at the type of debt, and then I'd go and look at how it's treated under state law, because some states will treat different types of debts, open end, closed end, just revolving, whatever, medical, differently. So what you're hearing is, I'm telling you have to spend more time, effort, and money researching state law, I think, to know the answer. But maybe somebody else knows.
No, Stephanie's right. And then not only do you have to look at the statute of limitations, but now you also are going to have to figure out if that debt can be revived and whether or not you need to give a revival disclosure. to which the CFPB does not really give any guidance.
I mean, this is clearly a Lawyer Employment Act as well. In that, you know, for all of us, particularly on the panel who represent clients, if we haven't already, we're already getting requests for, okay, give me a 50-state compendium of exactly the questions that Stephanie just raised. I want you to identify every state, every statute of limitations in each state, whether they can be revised, whether it's not. And then we have the big factor, which is, forget what the law says, you have to rely on the information you're provided by your client. Your client tells you there hasn't been a payment since X date, and that's wrong. That totally throws off your statute of limitations calculation. I can't tell you the number of times I've had clients who have said that their underlying client has told them that a last payment was a particular date. And as you dig down into the records and litigation, you find that really wasn't a payment. It was a credit back to the account that the client put back on there. But because of the way the system looks to everyone else externally, it looks like the individual made a payment when they in fact never made a payment and hadn't made a payment for months or even years before. But they're using that last date as the date from which to calculate a statute. And that's just wrong. But you're not going to know that. You're not going to know that when the account is assigned. You're not going to know that until you're sued. Then maybe that's where the play of know or should have known comes in. And the argument, as Joanne noted before, of, you know, what discovery is it going to really be to try and determine if you knew or should have known, and what judge is going to say, well, you should have known that because you should have asked the questions, versus a judge that says, how could you possibly have known that without asking the questions, and you have no obligation to ask the questions. So it becomes not just a legal question, but a factual question of when the statute runs, that in a lot of cases, none of our clients or no one in the industry is going to have a true definitive answer until they're challenged by somebody externally.
Right.
Okay. Another question. Do you open yourself up to claims of being false and deceptive if you include the disclosure on an instat account or one that is approaching the statute of limitations, but it's still in stat?
I think you do. I mean, I don't think you should be giving it unless you have, you know, or should know the debt is out of statute. If the debt is in statute, and you give the disclosure, I think you have, you know, and then you go to sue it, I think that's a lawsuit.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Easy.
But if you don't sue it.
But if you don't sue it, then I think if you, and you've cleared it with your client and they're not going to sue it, and then I think that's one thing. But if there's the possibility that you or some, it's in statute for long enough that either you or your client may decide to sue, then I think you need to stay away from the disclosure.
Yep. I agree with that.
I'll throw this out there for my panelists to comment on, and I kind of know the response, but I figured get at least a couple people to yell at me. What if, in order to avoid that situation, you know, the beginning of the disclosure would say, we believe, based on the information available to us, that your statute of limitations runs until X date, and you fill in the date, whatever it is that you're using. And then you put the disclosure, thus giving them the opportunity to understand that if it's July 1st and sending your letter out on June 1st, they have a month left. And I'm not saying that anybody wants to do that, but would that, you know, would that change anybody's mind?
No.
And I don't think, I mean, I don't even think doing, adding to the disclosure is a good idea. I mean, they've given us the language, don't stray from the language, just like, you know, the validation notice. This is going to become part of that for those who collect on out of stat debt. Don't mess with the language.
Okay.
another question. If the supplemental proposal becomes a final rule, do consumers have a private right of action against the debt collector for violating these out-of-statute debt disclosure rules?
Well, I would think so, just as a violation of the FDCPA.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see, some of these other questions. Let's try and get through these. When incurring, this is a general statute question. When incurring a debt, does the statute of limitations apply to the state the debt was incurred in or the state you presently reside in?
That's exactly what we'd like to know.
Welcome to the club.
Is there a choice of law provision? Hang on.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll tell you, just the other day, a case came out. You'll have to forgive me, everyone. I don't remember it. It came across. It might have been, Mike, it might have been on your publication because I read that every morning with CCN. But there was a case that came out and said that we are looking to the state the contract was originated in as opposed to where the person was located. I don't remember the specifics. I apologize. But it definitely, normally you're thinking about collection activities and the applicable state laws that apply there to be where the consumer is, right? Because you're directing the activities to the consumer. And if it's different from where they originated the contract, that's generally what we do. But here you're talking about the statute of limitations. So there's certainly an argument you can look at, well, what was the state law that we said would apply to it? And is it broad enough to cover this? So you can do that choice of law type of analysis. But then if it turns out the consumer is in a state that would apply a shorter statute of limitations, you know they're going to be arguing for that. And what happens if that state on top of that has a borrowing statute that actually says, yes, the shorter one will apply because it's more protective and because the consumer lives here, we're going to do that. Or the state where the contract was signed has something that says we will apply the statute of limitations where the consumer is located when it's more protective. So it gets to be incredibly convoluted. Which is going back to why I wish that we could get direction on, we can use it based on where the consumer lived, based on the last time that we actually had a successful communication with them, absent actual knowledge to the contrary, or something like that, to give some sort of contouring to this analysis.
And that's exactly with putting that analysis that you're going to have an expectation that businesses, mostly with non-lawyers involved in the operation of the business, are going to somehow be able to make that analysis on their own, and that you're going to hold them to that standard with serious and significant consequences if they are not calculating that number correctly, is the difficulty in this proposal and what's going to be imposed on them. I mean, that's a burden. I mean, you can't do that without a lawyer. And even when you have a lawyer, it doesn't mean you're getting the right answer. And so, you know, the cost of doing business, even with the proposal as it is, just went up significantly.
Unless there is a new strategy, and that is sue earlier.
Well, then you're involving lawyers anyway.
Right. But, I think, and this was discussed in the SBRIFA process, it was discussed in the NPR and a lot of the comments, if there is going to be, you know, some sort of ramification for time barred debt, then maybe the simplest and easy process is to, you know, not wait that long and sue quicker. Especially, I think, for creditors, you know, who are going to be on the hook for their vendors to be doing collection, going to have to be on the hook for maintaining information about payments for a longer period, you know, for a longer period of time, then maybe it's going to be, you know, you're only going to have this account for 6 months because although we think the statute of limitation is 5 years, we're going to sue it in two. I don't know, but it's certainly going to be something, an analysis that many creditors are going to go through as they start to outsource accounts.
Okay. Well, we've just about run out of time, but before we wrap up today, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and give each of our panelists a chance to offer any parting words of wisdom, any concluding thought, maybe something they didn't get a chance to mention but wanted to, just because the discussion didn't head in that direction, but just a chance to sort of summarize the conversation today, if they don't mind. Stephanie, would you mind going first?
I would echo Joanne that it's very important that even though it's one more thing and it can be burdensome and for some costly, getting comments in is important. Responding to this is important. I think that another thing to think about is the Bureau is proposing, we didn't talk about it, but to the extent that you transact communications with consumers and collecting their debt in Spanish, you have to translate these disclosures into Spanish as well. Or if it's partial English and partially Spanish, I don't know what that means. I don't know how much is it enough to just, when they call in and you say, hi, this is Stephanie, and they say no habla, does that count as partial? But if you serve a large population of limited English proficiency consumers, you might want to be attentive to that too, because I felt like that went a little bit further than what we saw with the limited English proficiency proposals last year.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Joanne?
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, everybody, for joining, and thanks to my panelists. We didn't get to talk about, but I think it's worth noting, and again, should be included in your comments. There's going to be a lot of conflicts with state law with these proposals. I mean, there are some states that already have time-barred debt disclosures, and they're either similar or identical, and you've got to put both on the letter or in your validation notice, or in maybe even your oral disclosures. I mean, you might have to make two sets of disclosures, the federal disclosure and a state disclosure. If that's not gonna be confusing for consumers, I'm not quite sure what is. And a lot of states like New York require those disclosures to be on the front of the letter, as does the federal proposal here. So if you are collecting in multiple jurisdictions or even a particular jurisdiction that does require a time-barred debt disclosure, you should be commenting because we need to figure out a process that's a little bit more efficient and also, more importantly, really helps the consumer understand what their rights are. If they're going to read two disclosures, repetitive disclosures, they're going to be quite confused as to what they should be doing.
Excellent. Thank you. Rick?
Thanks, Mike, and thanks to Britt, Stephanie, and Joanne for jumping on the panel and tolerating my occasional blatherings on various topics. And I'll conclude with one, which is generally we look at this proposal and a lot of people ask why now, what is this? And I think that in the business place, we would be remiss if we tried to divorce the operation of the business and the efficiency, which certain protocols would be if there weren't a part of a regulation. If we dismiss that and don't consider, where is public policy going? On a side note, we've seen it with the TRACE Act and with robocalls. There is a definite clamor from a vast majority of Americans against robocalls, and they're not going to look into the fine details, and policymakers are going to react because of it. You see the same thing with in debt collection with respect to out-of-statute debt. You just merely need to pick up the cover of the Washington Post to hear phrases such as zombie debt. You need to just look at an article, watch an expose on Dateline or 2020 to see about horrible things that take place in the collection industry, to understand that policymakers feel under extreme pressure to respond, even if it is imperfectly, to real perceived public policy issues. Statute of limitations and debt collection is not going to go away. And yes, in large part, many of the issues stem from the fact that we need to do a better job with financial literacy and financial education. But the fact is that most people don't. And so they don't understand where their account is or what has happened or if it's been sold or it's something they forgot about from 5 years ago and don't recognize it today. And government has responded. So I think if we keep that in mind and we look at it and try and work within that framework, instead of simply saying, that we can't do any, that government shouldn't do anything about it, we'll be better off in at least trying to make some mechanisms that help the industry cope and navigate through those political waters. But I don't think that they're going anywhere away anytime too soon. And we just need to be cognizant and be at the table to articulate our concerns so that we can work through the system. But don't be under the impression that it's going to go away, because issues like this are here to stay.
Awesome. Thank you. Britt?
Yeah, so first, thanks, Mike. This is my first webinar with you. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks to Rick, Stephanie, and Joanne. You guys are rock stars, so it's an honor to be on a panel with you. I'm just going to end with some practical advice, some quick practical advice. I know we're over time at this point. So if you're overwhelmed reading the rule, but you should comment, okay? Absolutely, I agree with Stephanie and Joanne. Comment, comment, comment. Yes, it's one more thing. Your comment doesn't have to be long. It can be a page. It can be two pages. Try to make it personal to your business, whether that's an agency, whether that's a law firm. How could this rule affect you? It's important. So my quick Cliff Notes tip is, if you're having trouble focusing on what to write on, go through the proposal and just search for the word request. And that will give you, as you go through the document, every place where the Bureau is going to request a comment. And if something grabs you, start writing on that. So that's my quick practical tip, because the more comments that the CFPB gets in, hopefully the better the final rule will be. So thank you.
Awesome. Appreciate it. Joanne, Stephanie, Britt, Rick, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. Really appreciate on something that came out just 6 days ago, such detailed analysis and perspective. Really look forward to this and all the perspective that is to come as we move forward with this proposed rule. TCM, want to thank you one last time for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate that. Please go to www.tcn.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated. A final reminder to please fill out the feedback survey and share any ideas that you'd like to see addressed in an upcoming webinar. That's where most of these topics come from. It's from suggestions from the audience on what they'd like to learn more about or issues that they're currently having. So please feel free to share, and we'll definitely get those queued up for a webinar in the future. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, awesome job. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.